You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. A New Yorker profile of Ocean Vuong begins. Ocean Vuong is not an experimental poet, but he is a poet of the American experiment. As the current administration tries to close our borders geographically and psychologically, both of tonight's distinguished guests, Ocean Vuong and Viet Tran Nguyen, remind us of how essential immigrant voices are to the American cultural and moral landscape. Both of these daring writers, who are, as Viet Nguyen writes, born in Vietnam but made in America, resist labels. Ocean Vuong's first collection of poetry, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, won a 2016 Whiting Award and was a finalist for the Kate Tufts Discovery Award. Quote, visceral, tender, and lyrical, the selection committee noted, these poems unflinchingly face the legacies of violence and cultural displacement, but they also assume a position of wonder before the world. And wonder, truly, we need it. Born outside Ho Chi Minh City in 1988, Vuong emigrated to Hartford, Connecticut when he was 2 years old. In the story of his name, or his renaming, he carries an immigrant's astute perceptions about how we are all connected. Ocean, born Vinh Quoc Vuong at birth, answered the phones in the nail salon where his mother worked as a manicurist. And when she learned that oceans touch many countries, Vietnam and the U.S., for example, she renamed her son. He earned his BFA at Brooklyn College, where, from poet-novelist Ben Lerner, he was introduced to the notion that, quote, a life of writing might be possible. In addition to Night Sky with Exit Wounds, he's the author of the chapbooks No and Burnings, and his work has been translated into Hindi, Korean, Russian, and Vietnamese. Since his last appearance here at Aloud with Maxine Hong Kingston to discuss his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer, and his nonfiction title, Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, Viet Tran Nguyen has gone on to win many more much-deserved honors for his work, and his most recent work is a short story collection. We have it for sale tonight, The Refugees. He is the Errol Arnold Chair of English and Professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. He's also a freelance critic for the Los Angeles Times. And this week in the New York Times, in the front page of the book review section, you can read his very fine review of Mohsen Hamid's excellent and just published novel about refugees, Exit West. So we're going to start tonight with a reading by Ocean, followed by his conversation with Viet Nguyen, then your questions. So please welcome both of our guests to the stage of the LA Public Library.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Is this a good volume? Thank you for being here. Thank you for allowing this space to happen and for allowing two Vietnamese-American writers to be seen and heard. When I first began writing, I never thought a night like this would be possible for me. But I've learned as a writer that one is best when one privileges discovery and surprise. So here's to being surprised, and what a great surprise to share this stage with Viet Tran Nguyen, someone whose first book, Race and Resistance, I encountered in a little bookstore in Rhode Island. And I just saw the title, and I said, that's my whole life. You know, and here it is contained in a book. You know, I was both stunned and skeptical, but absolutely exhilarated. And when I saw that it was a Vietnamese person, there was a sort of invisible bridge that started to form And I was really happy to be at one end of it. And here we are meeting on that bridge. So thank you. Thank you for being here. And thank you, Viet, for doing what you do and making my life as a writer possible from what you've been doing all along. Thank you. I like to begin, when I can, with this poem. It's in the voice of my mother. My mother can't read or write. The war in Vietnam interrupted her education. And I wrote this imagining what she would say if she could write a poem. It begins with a Vietnamese proverb. Không có gì bằng cơm với cá. Không có gì bằng má với con. Head first. Don't you know? A mother's love neglects pride, the way fire neglects the cries of what it burns. My son, even tomorrow, you will have today. Don't you know? There are men who touch breasts as they would the tops of skulls. Men who carry dreams over mountains, the dead on their backs. But only a mother can walk with the weight of a second beating heart. Stupid boy, you can get lost in every book, but you'll never forget yourself the way God forgets his hands. When they ask you where you're from, tell them your name was fleshed from the toothless mouth of a war woman, that you were not born, but crawled headfirst into the hunger of dogs. My son, tell them the body is a blade that sharpens by cutting. This next poem follows the trajectory of a bullet, an imaginary bullet, if you will, through time and then forward again. My imagining of this piece was that a lot of brown bodies have been written in the Western canon as the product of violence, often at the ends and means of violence, reductively. And I figured, here's my chance to take it back and see my people and recognize the fact that we moved and we exist out of violence. But it's also a place where we can remember, redraw, and rebuild ourselves. Self-portrait as exit wounds. Instead, let it be the echo to every footstep drowned out by rain. Cripple the air like a name flung onto a sinking boat. Splash the kapok's bark through rot and iron of a city trying to forget the bones beneath its sidewalks, then through the refugee camp, sick with smoke and half-sung hymns, a shack rusted black and lit with Bawai's last candle, the hogs' faces we held in our hands and mistook for brothers.
Let it enter a room illuminated with snow, furnished only with laughter, wonder bread and mayonnaise raised to cracked lips as testament to a triumph no one recalls. Let it brush the newborn's flushed cheek as he's lifted in his father's arms, reefed with fish gut and marbles, everyone cheering as another brown gook crumbles under John Wayne's M16, Vietnam burning on the screen. Let it slide through their ears, clean like a promise, before piercing the poster of Michael Jackson glistening over the couch into the supermarket where a Hapa woman is ready to believe every white man possessing her nose is her father. May it sing briefly inside her mouth before laying her down between jars of tomato and blue boxes of pasta. The deep red apple rolling from her palm, then into the prison cell where her husband sits staring at the moon until he's convinced it's the last wafer God refused him. Let it hit his jaw like a kiss we've forgotten how to give one another. Hissing back to 68, Ha Long Bay, the sky replaced with fire. The sky only the dead look up to. May it reach the grandfather fucking the pregnant farm girl in the back of his army jeep, his blonde hair flickering in napalm blasted wind. Let it pin him down to dust where his future daughters rise, fingers blistered with salt and Agent Orange. Let them tear open his olive fatigues, clutch that name hanging from his neck, that name they press to their tongues to relearn the word live, live, live. But if for nothing else, let me weave this death beam the way a blind woman stitches a flap of skin back to her daughter's ribs. Yes, let me believe I was born to cock back this rifle, smooth and slick like a true Charlie, like the footsteps of ghosts misted through rain as I lower myself between the sights and pray that nothing moves. A lot of this book attempts to navigate the mythologies that we create with history, through history. And one of this moment was to speak in the voice of Jackie Kennedy. And I thought, at first, I had trouble maneuvering into that. I was so obsessed with the Kennedys. Of course, JFK being one of the first orchestrators of the Vietnam War. But what did I have in common, I thought, with this elite white woman? And when I saw the iconic film, The Zapruder Tapes, in Dallas, I realized that we both are bounded by this history and the proximity of the people we love being obliterated by violence. And from there, I found footing into her voice. Of thee I sing. We made it, baby. We're riding in the back of the black limousine. They have lined the road to shout our names. They have faith in your golden hair and pressed gray suit. They have a good citizen in me. I love my country. I pretend nothing is wrong. I pretend not to see the man and his blonde daughter diving for cover, that you're not saying my name and it's not coming out like a slaughterhouse. I'm not Jackie O yet, and there isn't a hole in your head, a brief rainbow through a mist of rust. I love my country, but who am I kidding? I'm holding your still hot thoughts in, darling. My sweet, sweet Jack, I'm reaching across the trunk for a shard of your memory, the one where we kiss and the nation glitters. You're slumped back, your hand letting go. You're all over the seat now, deepening my fuchsia dress. But I'm a good citizen, surrounded by Jesus and ambulances. I love this country, the twisted faces, my country, the blue sky, black limousine, my one white glove glistening pink with all our American dreams.
This final poem, I came upon this poem, Frank O'Hara poem, a New York school poet, and he had this poem in his called Katie, in which he says, "Someday I'll love Frank O'Hara." And I thought, what a courageous and tender thing to articulate, for it to be this goal that we forward ourselves towards, which is self-love. And I had a friend, my friend Roger Reeves wrote a poem like that as well. "Someday I'll love Roger Reeves." And so he gave me this permission to write it for myself. "Someday I'll love Ocean Vuong. Ocean, don't be afraid. The end of the road is so far ahead. It is already behind us. Don't worry. Your father is only your father until one of you forgets. Like how the spine won't remember its wings, no matter how many times our knees kiss the pavement. Ocean, are you listening? The most beautiful part of your body is wherever your mother's shadow falls. Here's the house with childhood whittled down to a single red tripwire. Don't worry. Just call it horizon, and you'll never reach it. Here's today. Jump. I promise it's not a lifeboat. Here's the man whose arms are wide enough to gather your leaving. And here the moment just after the lights go out, when you can still see the faint torch between his legs. How you use it again and again to find your own hands. You asked for a second chance and are given a mouth to empty out of. Don't be afraid. The gunfire is only the sound of people trying to live a little longer and failing. Ocean, ocean, get up. The most beautiful part of your body is where it's headed. And remember, loneliness is still time spent with the world. Here's the room with everyone in it. Your dead friends passing through you like wind through a wind chime. Here's a desk with the gimp leg and a brick
to make it last. Yes, here's a room so warm and blood close. I swear you will wake and mistake these walls for skin. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
First thing to note is that we did not deliberately dress this way, did not communicate in advance. As a matter of fact, when I was getting ready for this, I thought usually I would wear a blazer, but I thought poets never wear blazers. I'm just going to be overdressed.
I was going to wear a suit with the white thing. And I thought, I don't want to be like a mini Viet Nguyen.
Well, couldn't help it.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite poems that you just read, and I thought, I could never write a poem like that. Mm. Because I thought, you know, I could never actually put my own name into my work. I thought about doing that, and I certainly could never address myself in my own work.
Right.
And to me, it seems that this poem typifies so much of your writing, because to me it seems very courageous to confront yourself directly like this.
Yeah.
But also, it contains so much of your own voice in it as well, with trademark stylistic features, beautiful images, and so on. Was it a hard poem for you to write that one?
It was hard, but necessary. And I think as a writer, when you approached that feeling of you cross this threshold where the risk is inevitable, where the momentum of everything you've lived through demands you to move into this space, it became its own momentum, so I don't know if it was hard. It was terrifying, yes, but I think for myself, you know, I'm not sure if I'm courageous in that sense, but that my sense of urgency outpaces my terror, right? And so that's how I get the work done, is that there are so many people, queer, brown people before me, who didn't get a chance to speak and whose actual bodies were erased because of that. Because of speaking, because of larger systems. And so when I approach the poem, I feel like there's this burning desire to get it through, to speak. And I think sometimes that surpasses the terror. But I always feel like I'm writing to the terrified versions of myself. And I figured, you know, if I'm going to do it, why don't I just really do it here in this poem?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where it was.
Well, I think it's that impulse that gives such tremendous force and power to the poetry. And I want to read you one quotation from someone who's writing about you in the Rumpus magazine. Mm. And this writer says of you that Ocean's gift is not for avocados and fresh laundry, but for shocking the most jaded of readers with devastating earnestness. Mm. Do you like that description of yourself as a poet?
You know, I love it. Well, I love that there are descriptions, and there's this. I mean, anytime I think when you write a book, for myself, I write a book and I create my private sort of town square. And readers, you know, if I'm lucky to have them, they just meet there and they do whatever they want. They could go in, you build this space, this room, if you will, and a reader steps in. Whatever they see is part of their interaction with it, and I can't tell them that it's wrong. Or it's off, you know, because that's how I felt most liberated as a reader myself, when I came with my own conclusions, you know. If Whitman came back from the dead and said, you know, Song of Myself is actually about baseball, right? It wouldn't make the text any less true, right? We would still have already taken what we needed from it, had this dialogue with the writer, and I think ultimately, reader and writer are always creating. And I think as long as we're reading, we're making spaces. We're making the spaces in relation to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And I think that's, like in Sympathizer, you created a universe based on history, but you created this sort of parallel space where now we move through history, we embody it, we're pulling it through, and we're in this entire world of this person. We surrender so much to it. Right, and yet we participate. Oh, how am I empathetic with this person whose life is so different from me, or whose life is in a temporal space that I've never got to live through, right? I think that's the power, because we're always having a dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's certainly the sense that there is an Ocean Vuong in the book, mm-hmm. the persona,
right.
and Ocean Vuong, the poet, the persona, separate yeah. from you as yeah. as an individual and as a writer. And it's a very seductive persona, for at least for me. Mm-hmm. You know, seeing you read, seeing you perform, this is the second time I've heard it. The poems are exhilarating, and your performance of it is very powerful and moving to me. And I think that maybe one of the reasons why we resonate, because we've shared a lot of, you know, bonding time behind stage, talking about how we're Vietnamese-American writers and these identities are important mm-hmm. to us. But I think one other thing that we share, going back to this question of earnestness and whether or not it's really a completely accurate description of your entire work, mm-hmm. is that I think we're also both committed to what you've said in one of your poems, which is that your work is to say the unsayable.
Yeah.
Right? Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've brought up the issue of voice, about the opportunity to speak that other people don't have, especially poets of color.
Right.
And to me, it's looking at your biography and what you've spoken about, it seems that this impulse to say the unsayable, this urgent, this drive towards honesty, this drive towards earnestness, if that describes one part of what you do, mm-hmm. is rooted in some of your own biographical experiences.
Yeah.
And for a poet, you have a great origin story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you should fill in some of the blanks, but, you know, coming here at 2 years old as a refugee
mm-hmm.
To Hartford, Connecticut, and with an illiterate family, and you didn't learn how to read until you were 11.
Yeah.
Maybe you can fill in the blanks for us yeah. about how did a poet come out of this biography?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I didn't learn how to read well until I was 11. You know, I was in the school system, and I struggled. My family actually struggles with learning disabilities. My brother is dyslexic, and I think part of that is it forced me to slow down. And, you know, we talked about Octavia Butler, and she was also dyslexic, right? And I think it forces us to read in that participatory way that I spoke about, where we're not reading to get this sort of pillaging answers or theses, but we're reading to be inhabited and be inhabited by the text as weather, as world. And I think I was forced to do that. But, you know, we think of origin stories, and I understand that in the literary context, in this privileged space of the literary world, my life is very, quote-unquote, unique. But I think the reality for myself is that our entire history as a species has been wrought with violence and displacement. And so, in fact, it's a very common trope. And yet, few of us get to be here to speak, right? People like you and I. And I think, you know, we share that sort of urgency, at least I feel in your work. But there are many people with more, 10 times more interesting lives that just didn't get to speak. The person with the next great book is washing dishes, right? Bent over doing nail salons, rubbing people's feet, working in factories, right? And that's where a lot of my family are from. And I think I feel very privileged to be able to be here and have, you know, this book as a technology, as a vessel. And that's what it is to me, this sort of vessel that we get to speak with. But I don't know if it's special or any unique to me. I think there's so many more lives that are special that get lost without being articulated.
Well, you know, you and I share a common background in terms of being refugees and yeah. being displaced, although yeah. your refugee experience is very different than mine. And even though I was a refugee and my parents were not educated, they didn't go to college, for example, I was raised with all the benefits that would lead me to becoming a writer, you know, very good schooling and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas you, when I'm saying that you have a great origin story, you didn't have those kinds of benefits. So even though you're pointing to people who wash dishes and so on,
yeah.
you yourself didn't come with these kinds of literary advantages.
No.
And you
worked
yourself
in a
did,
tobacco farm.
Yeah, you worked in a tobacco
yeah.
farm, and you know, you worked in the nail salon a little bit with your mother
yeah.
as well, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the shared experiences that we have as refugees help to turn us into writers.
Yes.
Certainly did for me.
Yes.
And when I listened to you, I think so too. And I want to read a little bit more about from your biography, and how you talked about your family. I think this is actually someone talking about you. He always wanted to know more, but his elders resisted going too far. Mm-hmm. You were asking your parents and your mom, your parents and your grandmother about this history, and they didn't want to talk about this history that you wanted to know about. Right.
Yeah. You're confronted, I think, and I think a lot of first and second, 1.5 or second generation immigrants and refugees experience this sort of sense of when we look back and ask and sort of interrogate the survival of our elders, it's seen as an act of betrayal in many ways, right? Why are you interrogating my pain when I moved here to make you happy, when I moved here for you to have a happy life? Why are you interrogating what I survived, right? And I think there's a discrepancy there, and there's a disconnect, there's a distance. And I had to explain that to my family, that I'm doing this to preserve that act of survival. And I think when they see, when maybe they'll never understand, really, but that's the confrontation. And my mother, the first time she went to one of my readings, this was in Hartford, and we're in the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, of all places. And the reading's over, and I go back with her, and I see she's crying. And I say, Mom, why? You didn't understand, you can't understand it. Why are you crying? And she said, I never thought I'd live to see all these old white people clapping for my son. And I, when I go give a reading, I don't think about that. That doesn't come to my head, and that's where we're different, right? But when I remember that here's a woman who kneels down, lowers her head every day to old white people when she's doing their pedicures, right? That's her job. That's part of her livelihood. And that act, although it's an equal, fair exchange of work, is not nothing. There's meaning in that act of supplication, this sort of, head lowered just to do the very practical act of giving a pedicure. And I think for the first time, they were also clapping for her.
There's a moment in one of your essays where you talk about your uncle, who was only a few years older than you, and he was also working in the nail salon as well. And he spoke English, but he was shy, he never said anything.
So the
people in the customers in the nail salon would talk about him
as
if he didn't understand. And what were they saying?
What a shame. He would be, he's so young, what a waste, right? And this is someone.
The essay spoke about your uncle committing suicide, and you went into that. And it was a powerful essay. I bring them up because, in relationship to your mother, because I think this is a very common experience for Vietnamese people, but also refugees, immigrants who come in who work these kinds of jobs, and they're just the furniture in these kinds of places to service people.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why I've only ever actually gone to a Vietnamese nail salon once. And it was an uncomfortable experience because I could converse with the woman doing my pedicure. The only time I ever had a pedicure. But everybody else was not a Vietnamese person who was a customer. And I felt I don't want to be serviced by Vietnamese people in this way for the very reasons that you're
talking about. The pronouns make it, the derangement of the pronouns, right? When the person bending lower to you is a go, right, or ji, and all of a sudden it's very difficult to speak to an elder, to speak down to an elder, right? And so I think part of the reason why my mother, it's so difficult for me to try to teach my mother to read. I tried, but how does a son direct a mother, right? The only grounding she has in the world where she is often mute, often invisible, often below and beneath, is that that's my son, right? I made that, right? And so for me to teach and be this authority figure, it fractures the last remaining strong tether that we have. And so I let it go, And we speak through presence. I had to learn living in a family of illiterate, and you know, and also their language, their Vietnamese, is fifth grade level at best. And so I had to learn to communicate through presence. And for the Vietnamese, a lot of love is articulated through service. We don't say, I love you, right? We cook, we massage, we gao yaw, right? We scrape each other's back, right? And so it's always this action. And it starts to inform the way I thought about language, that language is embodied, language is carried. And I think that's how I maneuver the rhythms in my work, the intuitive moments of the line break, the silences, the pauses, the alliteration, all of that is finding an embodied movement of language, carrying the language, which is why I seldom write. I carry and then I walk and I interrogate and have this sort of friction with the line. And write. The writing is the last part for me. I wonder how it was for you growing up and speaking in a Vietnamese household.
Well, I mean, it's very similar, although I think my distinction from you is that I didn't ask my parents questions because I think that I felt my parents were already working really hard, 12 to 14 hours a day. The last thing I wanted to do was bother them with questions when they when they came home. Right. And then when I let them tell me the stories, and that meant that what I absorbed from them were the stories that they felt were worth repeating. Mm-hmm. So any story that they thought was worth it, I would hear many, many times until I was sick of it. Right. And then when I was old enough to ask some questions, I thought, well, as you were saying, that I didn't want to make them talk about things they didn't want to talk about. Because the things they told me were already painful enough.
And then
to go into things that were unspeakable, that seemed to me to be a selfish decision on my part.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's the tension I think that you and I experience is we want to say the unsayable.
Yeah.
And yet for me to do that, I had to turn to fiction.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to take stuff from my parents' lives.
That's amazing.
But you, I think, now I don't know for sure what is autobiographical or not autobiographical in your work, but the persona is autobiographical.
Mm.
And so that when you write poetry, do you feel a tension there between the act of poetry and the act of autobiography? Do you feel there's a potential violation or extraction taking place if you do pull material out of lives that are not your own?
It's a tension that I have, you know, as an artist, just thinking. But I do think that at the end of the day, we inherit the genes of our elders. We also inherit their personalities and their stories. And it's interesting that you said you turned to fiction. You know, my sort of genesis with the storytelling in my family is, you know, I would do this thing where I would my grandmother would get me to pluck her white hairs out, right? And this is very common in Vietnamese, you know, right? And it's kind of like there's like a euphemism where they say, oh, take out my itchy hairs. They don't say white hairs, right? My itchy hairs, right? She'll say, you know, oh, come take out grandma's itchy hairs. I'm so itchy. So it's, you know, vanity in the guise of service, which is how everything works, right, in a Vietnamese household. Like, and so I would sit, she would sit, you know, between my legs, and I would, and to get me to, and I would, you know, I would get sleepy, I was like 6 or 7, and to get me to keep going, she would tell me stories, and she would tell me ghost stories, mm-hmm. right? And so that's, I hear ghost stories, I'm immediately alert. But the ghost story was also her story. The story of history. All of a sudden, you know, we're talking about a ghost story, but then now there are bombs. Now there are gunshots. Now there's a house on fire. Now, where did your mother come from? What did I do when I met your mother's father? Where does your aunts come from? There was this village over here, and over there was this girl. All of a sudden, we're back into that world. These blank walls of Hartford became this sort of time capsule. And likewise, you know, you hear the story over, and every time the story changes a little bit, right? And by the time you get to this ghost, it was almost an afterthought, right? That the mythology that she creates becomes an architecture for remembering and preserving and ultimately an act of inheritance. And so for me, myth-making, we can go all the way back to Homer, right? Homer wrote the Iliad 400 years after the Trojan War. So what did he invent and what did he inherit? But if he decided to be silent, we would lose everything about both himself, his people, and that war, right? And what they valued. And so I see the inheritance of a story like the inheritance of an object, right, that we create. Except the neat thing is that it's continuously being shaped and reshaped each time it's told.
So you said architecture.
Yeah.
Reminds me of something you wrote about in that essay for the Rumpus on your uncle. Yeah. He said, and in the essay, you were talking about your uncle's suicide, but you were also talking about fire escapes in New York City, right?
Yeah.
The poem, like the fire escape, as feeble and thin as it is, has become my most concentrated architecture of resistance, a place where I can be as honest as I need to be. But I still have my body, and with it, these words. And then in another section, I think this is actually from the poems, mm-hmm. you say the body is the book and one needs the body. I want to get to that connection between the body and writing, because it seems very, very important in your work. I mean, obviously the body as a theme and as a motif and what the body does is very omnipresent. But what is the relationship between the body and writing? Why is the body the book and why does one need the body in order to write?
I think, you know, a lot of times the way critics have carried other bodies of work, other texts, is often through the amputation of the person from the text itself, right? We think of how Harold Bloom praises Ashbery, but in many ways ignores, or at worst rejects, his homosexuality, his queerness. And, you know, we would know by reading the work that those are intertwined. How can you separate one part of a writer from his text, right? And that perhaps is clearest in the act of storytelling, which is why, you know, which how literature began. The first stories were our ancestors waiting for the meat to cook on the fire, looking at the stars, making up a story. And from that story, we get to know their joys, their terrors, what they cared about. And suddenly, it wasn't only about the story. It was about them, right? It was the DNA of their personhood articulated on the page. And so when I see a book, I see text, I see the fingerprint, the mental and emotional fingerprint of a person on the page. And without language, we wouldn't have that. Just like without body, we wouldn't have the language. To me, that's intertwined. And I think when we start to value text as much as we value bodies, we start to understand a more holistic idea of what a person is and perhaps value them more or better, mm-hmm. right?
So the body of the poet is definitely involved in the poetry itself.
Yeah.
And in the book, the body of Ocean Vuong, with the body of your narrator, is there, and the body of other men.
Yeah.
It's in a very important subject for the book. So there's one moment on page 39 where you say, to love another man is to leave no one behind to forgive me. I want to leave no one behind. Yeah. I wonder if you can unpack those lines for me.
You know, for me, there's so much there. And I sometimes I don't want to be coy, but I hesitate laying it all out, quote unquote, because in many ways that would take away from what a reader or a person got from it, right? The text is an object, right? And we all get to inhabit it and interact with it. But if I insist that this is my meaning, right, I start to claim it, I almost undo what I've done by offering it into the world. I start to take it back. And to me, this is the antithesis of what it means to be, you know, a writer in communication with the world, as opposed to a writer in communication with himself in a notebook or a diary or something like that.
Okay, I'm still going to ask you about the poetry, though.
Yeah.
Because I'm a critic, and now I'm in the role of an interviewer, so I have to ask you something. And if you tell me you're not going to answer, I'm going to have to go back at it again.
Fair enough.
Page 43, here's another passage from your poetry that really stood out for me among many passages and many, many, many lines. Okay. How one night, after backhanding my mother, then taking a chainsaw to the kitchen table, My father went to kneel in the bathroom until we heard his muffled cries through the walls. And so I learned that a man in climax was the closest thing to surrender. A beautiful, beautiful and violent and yeah. sexual set of images, which again, I think is a fair way of describing much of what happens in your poetry. And yeah. as we were talking about this in advance, I said, oh, you know, was this hard to write because it seems very autobiographical? And obviously, and autobiographically, you have spoken of your father mm-hmm. as well outside of the poetry, but you were telling me that you also made up parts of these things
yeah.
in this section as well. You don't right. have to tell us what you did or didn't yeah, make yeah. up. But yeah. again, I'm curious about that relationship between trying to mediate between what you know readers will know mm-hmm. of your autobiography right. and the construction of a scene and of the narrator in a particular poem
right.
and how the force, for me, the force of this, besides its force as a set of images and rhythm, is that invocation
right.
of the father and this very violent act that he's doing, this very secret act that he's doing
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Yeah. I think, you know, going back to the idea of the word poet in the Greek as a creator. And I think for myself, I see the act of the imagination in service of larger questions. And so as a poet, I often invent these spaces based on truths, right? And so we go back to Dickinson's, you know, age-old motto of tell the truth, but tell it slant. And in that scene particularly, I was interested in seeing fatherhood, and my father particularly, as an entire person, despite what he feels comfortable displaying, right? And so it was questioning masculinity and the vulnerabilities inherent in performing masculinity and how that starts to collapse and break down into violent ruptures, right? And so I think these scenes, they're always in service of this question, and I think I prioritize that last moment where what does it mean for a man to destroy within his family and then to escape through pleasure and climax, right? What is that for me? And I think it's this moment of surrender, it's this moment of letting go of himself, because the society and the culture has created a space where he can no longer perform in it. It's actually a straitjacket of masculinity. And what does that mean when you have to look up to be a man, right? To look up to him to be a man. What do you inherit then, right? And so for me, I try to inherit not necessarily what he performed, but where he failed, right? Where it fell apart. Because that's a lesson too. And I think failure, we live in a culture where failure is immediately doomed or blacklisted. But for me, I think failure, it's a worthwhile endeavor to reimagine and redefine failure for ourselves. What does it mean to fail well, fail better, as Steinbeck would say?
I think that this poem worked for me both as a poem but also as a commentary on Vietnamese American masculinity, which
yeah.
I'm pretty familiar with too.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, your I didn't need your explanation of it, but your explanation renders clear for the audience, I think, that this is what a lot of Vietnamese and Vietnamese American men face, that straitjacket of heterosexual masculinity,
yeah.
and then they take it out.
And also
on everybody
trauma,
else.
Right? Yeah. I think we don't a lot of this is ignored, how Vietnam is such a small, localized space, like no bigger than California, with thousands of years of warfare. And so what does that mean when destruction and loss has inhabited this extremely small space? What does it mean for the art, for the body, for the trauma? We know that through epigenetics that trauma is embodied. We inherit it. And so a lot of Vietnamese men suffer from mental illness, right? My uncle included, right? And so there's a reason why all of a sudden these people living through PTSD now have to perform these domestic acts. And I think that's often ignored in the drinking and the violence. They're struggling. And I think that's what I wanted to examine, because as I grew up in America, I started to see these white men, you know, start to inhabit similar struggles, where they started to fear this idea of failing at masculinity when they are already men, but they're failing, right? No homo, right? And so what you have is that you lose intimacy between men, and therefore you lose the humanity that men get to express, right? And I think I started to see that connection between these two spaces and how men exist, right, in that space.
Well, I still have a lot of questions, but I know audience members probably have questions too. So I want to turn it over to the audience and see what you have for Ocean Vuong.
Thank you for your beautiful reading. When I examine your work, I try to figure out how it's done, and you explained a little bit about alliteration and embodying it. But I'm still wondering if there's something you're trying to achieve, like maybe a sentence that has no period or something that is just moving or trying to be as expressive of as many ideas crammed into one sentence. I mean, even in hearing your reading, I can't put my finger on it. I don't know if it's being done on purpose or if it's just the way it naturally flows.
I think why I fell in love with poetry was that it allowed freedom in articulation, right? And so what does it mean when a poem ends without a period? What does that mean for the voice? Was it cut off? Was it unfinished, right? And all of a sudden, the removal of punctuation adds those questions, amplifies those concerns, right? I believe in one of Whitman's versions of Leaves of Grass, after Song of Myself, he left out, by accident, the period. But I thought that was the best version, right? Because it ends with, I stopped somewhere waiting for you, with no period, right? I have to participate in that perioding. Right, and I think formal manipulations add meaning, the way body add meaning, the way we sit, the way we lift, the way we talk, our voice, right? All those pressures is also language, right? The way you touch someone, the pressure of the hand on the skin, that's language, right? We all know that. And so I think when the poem starts to investigate form, and break form, redefine form, it's a radical act of reinvention and articulating beyond language. Think of Dickinson, her famous slashes, right, the dashes. For me, in the context of a patriarchal structure where all the men around her at that time was silencing her, rejecting her voice and imagination, what does the dash mean? It's this almost... this moment of visceral response when language is not enough. I have this. This is my attempt to keep speaking. And I think she had to knife the page in order to speak again on the left margin, right? And so when we look at this form, everything matters, right? Everything matters about it. And I think poetry allows for that space for me.
I myself I came here young too, and was wondering, was it difficult for you to come to a school where your first language was basically American, and your second was at home? How was it? Was it easy translation to home and outside? Does, if you do
yeah,
get
yeah.
the question.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. It's you know, it was very difficult because my family didn't speak English. And so by the time I was 5, I didn't speak English. And I remember, trying to fake it. They would recite the national anthem, and I would just move my lips along and wait for the pauses, you know, and I kind of you just learn a way to blend in, right? In order to make it to the next hour, the next class. And I think, on the other hand, that struggle, that demand to be perspicacious and attentive to the world, in the end, trained me to observe it as an artist, right? Nothing could be left out, because looking at the world was how you survive the world. Looking carefully at the world is how you thrive in the world. Knowing where you belong, knowing where you're safe, all of that. Right? Du Bois talked about the double conscious, and that's very rooted in how I felt as a young person. And in a way, you know, maybe this is the silver lining, is that I felt like I was training my whole life to be a poet in how to observe the world. I always think of the Simone Weil quote, where she says, attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. And that's what I feel as an artist. But I would try, my ambition would be to edit that and not say rarest, but most common and purest form of generosity. What happens when we turn attention into a common thing, when we start to see each other more carefully and more thoroughly? I think that's my larger question, and poetry is just one way of serving that. You want to answer that too?
No.
Okay.
Hi, thank you so much for everything. I just wanted to ask about, like, writing about heritage. It feels absolutely terrifying to me. My mom, like, defected from the Shanghai Ballet so she could be American and, like, have that sort of life. And there's so much trauma, like you discussed there. It seems like if you write about that, you're taking on, like, a filial weight. There's so much responsibility to get it right or do it justice.
Yeah.
And how do you deal with that?
You know, there's the obligation. But for myself, I felt informed by that story. And so if someone to ask me, what is your canon? Who are the writers that you admire, right? And on my imaginary bookshelf, it would be, you know, Dickinson, Lucille Clifton, James Baldwin, my grandmother, without skipping a beat, right? I do believe she is right up there, right? And so the relationship, how then can you not then? If we are having dialogue with our heroes, how do we not have dialogues with the people who informed us and gave us a story, but also a flesh? And so for me, the ultimate act of betrayal is to turn away from that story, turn away from that life. Even when they reject it, they reject your act, right? You have to find this commitment to yourself beyond that. Right? And sometimes it's a silent commitment. But in order to write, every word is your way of moving forward. And you have to make that commitment. It's not easy, but you had to find a way to do it.
Do you think writing your poetry has brought you closer to your family or alienated you from your family?
Both, in the sense that the more words I know, the further I move away from them. So the more I educate myself, the larger my vocabulary, whether it's in Vietnamese or English, I move further away from my family who are not as educated as I am, right? So there's this actual distancing. On the other hand, through the work, through these questions, it allowed me to be with them, to ask them, and to, in a way, enter their lives again where even they didn't want to, right? And then, in your book, Nothing Ever Dies, it's a wonderful book. You talked about how Toni Morrison said the re-memories, right? What do we mean when we create a novel, when we create a text as a re-memory? And I think I got to do that for them, with them. And so I do think of it as an act of collaboration, ultimately. There's, you know, I'm the first to read and write in my family. But I'm not the first poet. I always say that. There's one name on the book, but it's everyone there. You know?
Next question. I was just wondering, we have two artists on the stage with shared experiences who chose to express their art and their truth through writing. But one chose prose and one chose verse. one chose to write almost in an autobiographical sense, and the other through fiction, being influenced by their family's stories or the unwillingness to share the stories. And I was wondering if you could talk about that choice, both of you, whether it's commenting on each other's choices or your own choice.
Me first? Okay. Well, you'd asked me earlier, Ocean, did I write poetry? And I said, yes, in college, and it was very bad poetry. And it was sort of like Ocean Vuong poetry. You know, it was like, oh, let me talk about my personal life and let me talk about history in this very naked and emotional way. And I just felt that I wasn't very good at it. I wasn't very good at getting close to my emotions in a naked form, or even the pretense of a naked form. And for me, I was the kind of writer who needed distance from myself in order to access myself in a very strange way. Because like Ocean, I do believe that one of the writer's tasks is to say the unsayable. But there are different strategies on how to get there. And in my case, it was through the idea that through constructing a fictional persona who is nothing like me biographically, but who was like me emotionally and intellectually, I could use the fiction as a mask to give access to a different kind, to the truth that was inside of me, and to say the unsayable that way. And I wasn't the kind of writer who wanted to say the unsayable about my own life and my own family, but I wanted to say the unsayable about history, culture, politics. So that's a very different kind of unspeakable thing. But I think it takes a lot of courage to do what Ocean does, which I couldn't do myself.
I could say the same to you. I think, I wrote one book, and I don't see myself as only a poet. I don't see the genre as these fixed borders. For me, genre is as fluid as gender, as sexuality. And so I'm curious of what would happen in prose, right? For me, poetry for me was intimate because particularly of the breaking of language, the fracturing of syntactic pressures. That made sense to me. As the outsider relearning the language, we often stutter, we often double back, we have pauses. And for me, poetry became this language of outsiderhood to me. And I'm thinking of Paul Celan, who, as a Holocaust survivor, decided to continue to write in German. But in order to do that, he had to deranged the syntax to the point where it was no longer even barely legible, right, as German. So he created this third language for himself, right, as a way forward. And I think poetry was attractive to me because it allowed me to stutter, because I've always been stuttering, right, in my mind, in my sentences, in the way I think. There's ellipses. Our very history has full of ghosts and erasures in it. So poetry ultimately for me was a craft of erasure, right? A craft of breaking. But I don't feel fixed in it. For me, the larger question then is, how do I navigate issues and the intersections of violence as an American body, as a queer American body? How do I reckon with that history moving forward? I'm interested in what happens when form collapses, when it hits the point where it obliterates itself and yet has to continue. Because that's how I feel like right now as an American citizen. When we hit a point where everything is collapsing and yet time moves just as fast as before. And so we are continuing to move through time, being carried by it, without any choice. So my question for myself as an artist is, now what? What will you do to honor total obliteration and yet still have a life to work with? And so I am writing prose now. You know, it's a space where I feel like I get to expand on the same questions that I had in poetry. Thank you.
Next question.
Oh, no, I'm nervous.
I read that you no longer write right away because it cheapened like the language. So now you construct in your mind. So they say a pearl, for example, begins with a grain of sand. For you, what starts the poem? How long does it take? And do you have several pearls forming at the same time? Like, walk us through the process. Yeah. How do you create one?
Maybe you can chime in here too a bit.
No, it's okay. I
thought this was teamwork. if you asked me this 10 years ago when I first started writing, I would have a very clear, neat answer. I would even throw in some rules, But the longer I do this, I earnestly have to say that the only thing that feels true to me is to be a supplicant of the world, to pay attention to it and insist on the world's potency. Every interaction has a potential to be something else, right? I mean, that's what literature is to me. It's here, and then there's something else, and then we follow that elseness, right? Then we discover this whole new place. And I think I follow language. I follow strange thoughts. I follow strange bits of conversation, right? The way people talk to each other. Everything. It's really everything. And I think that's... I know that might not be the answer you want, but, the more I do this, the more I have no idea what I'm doing.
So I was kind of wondering, since I had discovered both of your works around the same time in a class, and I was wondering kind of what you feel like this state of like Vietnamese American literature is going to be, because I think you both occupy such a unique space in terms of winning the Pulitzer Prize and also a lot of like the power your poetry has done through the... So I was wondering, yeah, like what kind of like obstacles... Does that make sense? I'm just like kind of terrified right now. Yeah. Okay. Does that make sense?
Let the professor answer that.
I think Vietnamese American literature is in a pretty good position right now, and I think it's partially because we've been a well-colonized people. In other words, the French colonized us, the Chinese colonized us, but they left us with one of the gifts that they left us with was literacy and education and literature. And that's not always a benefit that ensues from colonization. So even if we talk about Southeast Asian colonization, the French in Indochina, they did not do the same for the Laotians and the Cambodians, which is why now these inequalities of colonization that existed in Indochina are transferred here to the United States. And Vietnamese Americans, even though we're a minority and we were colonized, we're still, at least in the sense of literature, better off than Laotian Americans and Cambodian Americans. And the result is we have a large group of Vietnamese American writers writing in English who have achieved national and international prominence. And we have another group of Vietnamese American writers writing in Vietnamese who are drawing from a completely different literary tradition, and they're very prolific in that tradition too. So I think that is that's a positive, right? But it's also an index to the degree of our colonization as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds perfect.
Yeah, final question.
Last question.
So my question is like more in regards to language. So as I think of Vietnamese, I think of really how I learned through my grandmother and her stories. And a lot of her stories is around sorrow and loss and how hard it was in Vietnam. So I actually really hardly know the words for happiness besides like vui, but I know more words like ko or ka or things like that. And it's really kind of shaped how I've learned. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask, do you find when you speak Vietnamese, there's a loss for words for things that we may not have ever really encountered, such as like whether it's mental health or things like that? And I don't know, how do you find that you express happiness or those kind of other emotions that we haven't really been able to really show through our families yet, or maybe
maybe not. Yeah.
That's all you.
You know, I love the Vietnamese language. There's a when I moved to New York 10 years ago, you know, to start my life, I would miss it so much that I would always pass through Chinatown and just follow Vietnamese grandmas just to hear it. It's I know it's weird, but I hear it and I would just start following them. And they're just running errands, you know, and I just want to be close to it. And so it's very powerful. But it's also this beautiful language of imagination and music, right? Even the human calf, bap chuối, right? The banana, but not when it's ripe. Bap chuối is the banana when it's closed. When you see a banana plant, the brown sort of cone that comes down looks just like the human calf. And so it's a way of, you know, it's always based on this storytelling. Language was itself a story. You know, what does it mean about the people, where they live, when they define this technology of movement as what nourished them? What does it mean when they have this enactment of the relationship between nourishment and forwarded and progress, right? And I think the Vietnamese language is full of that. Even the way we spell things, like the way we pronounce it. To me, it feels to me innately like a hybridity of meaning. Ma for mother, ma for ghost, ma for grave, ma, but, right? But this and that, right? Ma, 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 ma. You have to pay attention or you will lose yourself. And if a language demands that of you, it's a gift.
Well, please join me in thanking Ocean Vuong.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.